Hello everyone and welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Show. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at Cure Talk, and along with the Cure Talk team of Sharib Khan and Chintan Patel, I welcome all of you this evening to our live on-air myeloma support group meeting. We will be moderating the call and bringing people live on the show. Cure Panel Talk Show is organized by Cure Talk, the blog of Trialix.com, an online platform to connect patients to clinical trials of new treatments. For information on clinical trials, please visit Trialix.com/ask. And for information on clinical trials on myeloma, please visit MMRF site MyelomaTrials.org. This is the 17th episode of Cure Panel Talk Show and the second myeloma support group meeting on this platform. Our shows have crossed over 100,000 archive listens. Before we begin, I would like to remind everyone that the next Cure Panel Talk Show on myeloma will feature Dr. Shaji K. Kumar from Mayo Clinic and has been scheduled for July 25th at 7 p.m. ET. So please mail me your registrations and send in your myeloma questions for Dr. Kumar. Today's meeting is co-hosted by Pat Killingsworth. Pat needs no introduction. He is an author of 4 myeloma-related books and maintains 2 blogs where he documents his myeloma journey. Welcome, Pat. We also have with us our support group leaders, Cynthia Shmilevsky and Sue Van Zin. Cynthia is a myeloma survivor and an active member of the Philadelphia Multiple Myeloma Networking Group, a trained mentor and participates in several online communities. She is also very active on Twitter. Sue is caregiver to her husband, Harold. With the help of the International Myeloma Foundation, Sue and Harold started a myeloma support group for the West Michigan area, and Sue volunteers as a caregiver and advocate and travels to Dallas, Texas every July to assist the IMF at the annual support group meeting. Welcome, Cynthia and Sue. Listeners who would like to talk to the leaders may please press 1 on your keypad, and we will bring you live on air to share your story and ask your question. Pat would now introduce us to the topic for today's meeting. Pat, you're on air.
Thank you, Priya. And thank you, Cindy and Sue, for joining me this evening. I don't like to dominate things and talk all the time, but I wanted to explain a little bit what we're trying to do and why. Myeloma support groups the friends I've made and the experience has been wonderful, awesome. I realize that a lot of patients and caregivers need support too, aren't able to get to groups. Either there aren't any in their area. A friend of mine, Joyce, just started a group in Southwest Minnesota, about 150 miles from the Twin Cities, and that's a long drive for somebody to get to a support group meeting. And they're already up to 12 or 14 members and growing. The need is everywhere, but obviously either a group isn't going to be available or maybe the patient doesn't feel up to going, or maybe they're uncomfortable with the whole format. Now, I don't know if being live on air makes you feel any more comfortable, but, we're certainly all friends here, and I'm hoping that after a while people can call in with their questions and feel comfortable. And I must say that myeloma support groups tend to be Cindy's group. Cindy attends a group up in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, and they don't call theirs a support group. They call theirs a networking group. I know other groups that call theirs informational groups because there are so many different therapies. The questions about dosing and side effects and these are the dominant questions. As a matter of fact, Priya, we have a number of questions to get to tonight that were emailed to Priya, and they're all pretty specific, talking about therapy, possible options, transplant, that kind of thing, and that's great. We're not physicians. I live, breathe, and sleep multiple myeloma 24/7, but I'm not a physician. If somebody has a question about the pathology of the disease, how a cell splits off, why they react to a particular drug, I'm not your guy. But if you're looking for somebody that understands about which drugs seem to work, what physicians all over the country, heck, I get emails from all over the world, what they're prescribing, what the possible side effects are, ways that I know patients and their physicians have combated those side effects, that kind of thing, I think I can really help. And I probably know more specifically than a lot of medical oncologists about that very small little part of the medical world. But if you get into general medicine, I'm not your guy. Cindy has a lot of experience. She's gone out and spoken to dozens of different support groups. As the world-famous myeloma teacher last year at ASH, there are 30,000 clinicians, researchers all up in Atlanta. Big, you can imagine they've got a big fancy board of directors. And Cindy won the award for best tweeter at this 5-day conference. I mean, she's really great and helps get information out there. Sue and her husband helped start support group in Grand Rapids, Michigan. But I got to tell you, personally, I think Sue pretty much started the group, and Sue does a lot of the work. She's a caregiver, and I felt it's important that we always have a caregiver on this panel. Because like I said, caregivers need support too. And I believe Priya is working on a broadcast that will feature caregivers soon. So I'm hoping, I ramble sometimes once I get going, but I'm hoping that at some point we can talk about things that these groups don't talk about. Believe it or not, these groups rarely talk about death and dying. They rarely overall survival is sort of, and some of the stress can be swept under the rug a little bit. I'm hoping these are some of the things we can talk about here once everybody's comfortable with the format. But with all of that said, I'd like to get started. And I don't know, Priya, do you have anybody to participate to ask some questions?
Not yet, Pat. People who would like to ask a question, may please press 1. Yes, we have one person who's calling in from 561-392-1183. Please ask your question.
What the opinion is with regard to Zometa. I've gotten different opinions as far as how often to take the treatment, or perhaps maybe it's not even effective. I wonder if there's any thought about that.
Sure. Why don't I take that one, ladies, and then I'll let you introduce yourself a little bit more, and we'll continue. Bisphosphonates, the IMF Working Group, International Working Group, has set guidelines that say that anyone with active myeloma, whether they've had any bone involvement or not, this group's recommendation, and they include Dr. Palumbo from Italy and Dr. Dury with the IMF, there are 6 or 8 set on this board, a physician in Spain, and they all agree that either Zometa or Aridia is the older bisphosphonate that might be a little more conservative, that a patient use one of those for the first 2 years once a month. Again, these are guidelines, not my guidelines, the IMF's guidelines. Once a month for 2 years, and then after that, they leave it up to the discretion of the physician. There's been some bone involvement, like I know, for example, I take Aridia now every 3 months. Cindy, hi, Cindy, are you there? Are you on bisphosphonate, either Zometa or Aridia?
Yes. Can you hear me, or do I need to press in?
I can hear you.
Okay, I didn't know if I needed to press in. Yes, I'm on bisphosphonate, and I was on a bisphosphonate. I can't, that word is a big, long word, for 2 years, and now my doctor has altered my plan. I'm on it for about every 3 months now, too.
See, that seems to be a standard thing, and Sue, I hope you're not on Zometa, Sue.
I am not on Zometa.
How about Harold?
He was on it very briefly. They st- started him when he first was diagnosed. He had it once a month. Then he changed doctors, and they went to once every 6 weeks. And then he had his transplant in there, so they didn't give it to him. And he ended up only having a total of 4 doses, and he already had some signs of ONJ. So they took him off it, and he hasn't had any since then. And he hasn't really had much bone involvement, so I think they kind of monitor that, but he's not had to stay on Zometa.
Sure, and OMJ is the acronym for osteonecrosis of the jaw. And I know several people that have had some issues with it too. It's pretty unusual, but it can happen. I guess it's one of the more high profile side effects. I know Zometa, and I said Aridia. I'm sorry, I was on Aridia for many years. When I was a Mayo Clinic patient, they preferred Aridia. It's more conservative. It's infused over 2 or 3 hours, so it takes a long time. But that was supposed to lessen the chances of ONJ and some bone pain and that kind of thing. But now I'm on Zometa. I'm sorry, I didn't get the caller's name. Are you still there?
I'm still here. Yes, I am.
Does that help?
Yes, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Sure, and Zometa, by the way, of course, Novartis, you got to be careful with this stuff. Novartis is deep pocket, but they did a lot. They did some high-profile studies and determined that taking Zometa actually can help prevent new lesions from forming. But if I sound a little skeptical, you know, they worked pretty hard to get those results. But it did make a clinically significant difference. So I think most myeloma specialists want you taking it at least for the first 2 years. Great. Cindy, we've given you, you know, we've done your bio, but why don't you say hi and tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll do the same with Sue.
Okay. My name is Cindy Shimolewski, and I was diagnosed with multiple myeloma in July of 2008, so that was almost 5 years ago, so I'm coming up to one of those big milestones and ready to celebrate. And shortly after I was diagnosed, I found the Philadelphia Multiple Myeloma Networking Group, and that was a godsend because this group is a source of information. It helped me educate myself. It provided me comfort and emotional support when I needed it. So I was so very grateful that I found that group. Now, the Philadelphia group is a large group, so we have at any given time 200 members on our mailing list or more, and we have probably 50 to 60 members attending a group. So at the Philadelphia Multiple Myeloma Networking Group, we have a board of directors that help set the direction of the group and come up with speakers and what we should be having, and I happen to be on that board of directors. I'm not a support group leader, but I'm very actively involved in the planning of the meetings, and I do attend a support group leaders summit in Dallas to be educated to help facilitate the group. Is that good?
That's great. Thank you very much. And
okay, you're welcome.
And I appreciate you helping out. And Sue, if you could tell us a little bit about yourself and maybe about your husband when Harold was diagnosed, and I know he had a transplant, and sort of give us some background there.
Sure. My name is Sue Van Dyne, and my husband Harold was diagnosed in March of 2010 and had a transplant later that year in September, and he has been in CR ever since. He's been very grateful for that. And I guess he's a little unique, perhaps, in that his myeloma is IgA, where IgG is definitely more common. And he has a couple of the chromosome abnormalities. He has deletion of chromosome 13 and the translocation of 4 and 14. So in the beginning, we were told that, you know, his was a more aggressive form, but he responded quite quickly to medication. He started on Revlimid, Velcade, and Dex, and has, like I said, been in CR since his transplant. So I think he's been very lucky and feel very grateful, and he's pretty, you know, other than being tired from all the medication, he's been able to lead a pretty normal life. So we started the support group She had a transplant in September. The following June, we started a support group for the West Michigan area. We found at the time that there were three support groups, but they were all on the east side of the state in the Detroit area. So we started one here in Grand Rapids, and it's been very well attended. We have, I think our first meeting, we had 27 people come, and we averaged probably 30 to 35. We had a meeting last week with a speaker, and we had 65 people there. So there's been a real need for it here on the west side of the state, and we've really enjoyed it, gotten to know some wonderful people, and it's been a good thing. We've learned a lot, and have to share. It's not all always positive. There have been some sad things along the way, but it's been very rewarding.
Well, I know Sue and Harold are two of the nicest people I know. I met them down in Dallas at a support group summit, and then I went up to Grand Rapids and spoke at the name of the...
called Gilda's Club. Yeah.
Gilda's Club, right. Really a nice setup, and everybody ate before the meeting, and they showed me around town, a beautiful town, beautiful city, actually. And that was appreciated, but their hospitality was almost matched Cindy's when I was up speaking to her group here a few weeks ago when she had me into her home. So thank you both for helping out.
You're welcome.
Well, Priya, we have a whole list of questions to get to here, but if there's somebody that's called in, they should always take priority. Is there anybody there?
Not yet, Pat. I'll let you know when someone comes online.
That's great. Yeah, just jump in.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Okay, so we have, the last time I checked, it was 14 questions. There might be more. Sue, you were going to take the first question for us. It's from Kathy. And Kathy wrote, what do they think about transplant, and do we need it when so many drugs, I've got to flip the page, are coming out? And that's a very common question. So, Sue, what do you think?
Well, and we do get this question quite often in our group, especially to people who are newly diagnosed. And I guess what I tell people, I mean, it is definitely a controversial thing in the myeloma world. What is the best way to go at this point? I think usually the transplant seems to still be considered the standard of care. But what we always tell people, because we have a lot of people come too who are not transplant eligible, and that doesn't mean, you know, I tell them it doesn't mean you're a second-class citizen, that you certainly, with all the new drugs, they have been very successful as well. We also have people who have opted for harvesting their cells and then saving them for a transplant at a later date, and that's a very viable solution as well. I think there's not, you may have a different opinion, but there doesn't seem to be a one-size-fits-all answer to that question. I guess my feeling is that you really need to have a good relationship with a doctor that you trust. We feel it's really important to have a myeloma specialist on your team and, educate yourself as well as you can and make the decision that you feel is best for you. I don't think there's just one right answer to that question, but I think one thing we always tell people, too, is once you've made your decision on what you're going to do, don't second-guess yourself later and look back on, maybe I should have done this. Just, there's not one answer to that question. So I think just with your doctor, with his input, his or her input, and your, trying to educate yourself as best you can, you just have to make the decision you feel is right for you. So that's my feeling on that topic.
I'm glad, Sue, I'm glad you mentioned team. The topic for tonight's meeting is be your own best advocate, becoming an empowered patient. And one of the first steps, I think, is creating a healthcare team. And every healthcare team for myeloma patient needs a myeloma specialist. You don't have to go to that specialist all the time. So maybe you're an hour or 2 hours, or even have to fly somewhere to see a specialist initially. But then you can see a local medical oncologist or hematologist, and the two of them would work together, and that's the optimum situation, I think. And the time to see a specialist isn't necessarily when you're first diagnosed. That's a good time. But any time you're going to undergo, my opinion, my feeling is any time that you're going to, you're looking at making a therapy change. So early on, when you're thinking about whether to transplant or not, the medical standard of care, I have to tell you, for a patient in their mid-70s or younger in relatively good health is to go under induction therapy for 3 or 4 months, 5 months, however long it takes to get the myeloma under control. Most people, their myeloma is easy to handle early on, and then move to transplant. And so just because your doctor suggests that, that's what, if he goes online, that's what, like the IMF working group I talked about before, that's what they would recommend. But they shouldn't act like that's the only option. You could wait. And if I was newly diagnosed right now, I'm 6 years out, diagnosed in 2007, I would, I waited back then, and I think I'd wait again. As the studies show, you can wait and still get the same results. There are some risks in waiting. There are some good reasons for transplanting right away. But if you want to wait, your doctor should not be pushing you. And if your doctor pushes too hard and you're not comfortable with it, that's an excellent time to get a second opinion, especially if you're not seeing a specialist. So since I've already been giving all this medical advice, I'll jump in here to question two, which Elena asks, has anyone been faced with frequent and pervasive infections such as, and it's pyelonephritis, pyelonephritis. And I looked it up, and it's kidney infection. It's a kidney infection that's along the lines of the chronic bladder infections that especially women get. And so you can tell, because I don't even know how to pronounce the word, I'm probably not the guy to be asking, but no one else on the panel stepped up. That was smart. See how smart these young ladies are tonight. But I will tell you that it makes sense to me. This is a type of infection that when you have a low white count, especially an ANC count, an absolute neutrophil count, neutrophils, my understanding is they're the little white blood cells that attack this particular type of infection. And a lot of the myeloma drugs we take can lower our ANC count, and you'd be at risk of developing this kind of thing. So although I don't know anyone personally, it wouldn't surprise me that it's not uncommon. And it should be regular antibiotics, according to the WebMD and anything else I looked at should be able to take care of it. So let's not take any more time on that, since I'm quoting WebMD. That's not a good sign. Cindy, you're up for the next one. Justine asks, the best ways of treating neuropathy in your feet.
Okay, well, with neuropathy, I don't think there's just any one way of treating the neuropathy. I've been fortunate that my neuropathy has not been so great, so I'm just speaking from what I hear and other people talking about the neuropathy that they have. Sometimes you might need to see a neurologist, and that neurologist may try different approaches. One of the things that our group talks about is Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. They published a protocol that is supposed to help with some of the chemo-induced neuropathy. So if you go Google Dana-Farber Myeloma Neuropathy Protocol, they're a listing of different types of vitamins and supplements will pop up, and that may be something that you could try. Some people have success with that. Other members of my support group have said that they have had some success with drinking tonic water. So you could give tonic water a try, see if that helps. Hi, I think you drink tonic water, is that correct? That's not there? Okay. Other people have told me that if you do some rubbing of cocoa butter on your feet. Are you there? Can you hear me? Rubbing of cocoa butter on your feet, that may help. And sometimes I even heard putting bar of soap between sheets may help. I'm not too sure about that. There are also some prescription medications available for neuropathy. If you go on the IMF website, which is the International Myeloma Foundation, at www.myeloma.org, and Google the neuropathy there, they'll come up with a list of different types of prescription medication that you may try, and you might even talk to one of the hotline experts there. They may give some suggestions. But like before, we're talking about becoming an empowered patient, so I think the best thing would be to make sure your doctor knows that you have neuropathy and talk to your doctor about that, because sometimes some dose reductions or some scheduling changes in your chemo may help with neuropathy. And finally, another source of information might be joining like an online listserv, like the ACOR.org. This is a group of patients and caregivers that answer questions and share experiences. And they have archives there that you could search and you could see what other people have tried.
Great. Sue, any tips that you've heard in your support group? Because I'm sure this stuff comes up all the time.
Yeah, it does. And I think Cindy covered it really well. Those are all the same things I would suggest. I usually do give people a copy or give them access to that Dana-Farber website. I have heard doctors say at some of these conferences I've gone to that is one of the most frustrating things and difficult things for them with patients is, you know, it's such a common side effect from the chemo or from the disease, and there's not a simple solution to it. Every one of those things that Cindy said we've recommended, and I know some people do get some help from those things and some don't. So we wish there was a better solution to that, but there just doesn't seem to be.
There are several studies going on right now. It's a big deal. Peripheral neuropathy is huge.
It's
not so much because of chemotherapy. It's because most diabetics experience this as their disease progresses. And so you can imagine that's a huge market. And so there are a number of ongoing clinical trials right now and several new drugs coming out. And I'm going to be writing, I'm blogging about that. And I'm backed up a little bit, probably early next week, I'll have another neuropathy post that will talk about some of the prescription medications that Cindy suggested you can find on the IMF site. And I know there are several new ones coming out. So thanks, Cindy.
Yeah, and there's also on the website, neuropathy.org. It's the National Neuropathy Association. So maybe if you search that site, you might find something. So.
You're right, and ACOR supposedly has a neuropathy listing, although I signed up and I haven't really gotten anything. I must have done something wrong.
But
maybe it's just not very active right now.
Yeah, that's usually what happens. So if you search the archive of the ACOR list, you could see what people were talking about.
Sure. Well, you're our techno woman, so you'd know. Thank you. You're our technical consultant. All right, Darlene. Darlene asks, I read that amitriptyline, the trade name is Elavil, E-L-A-V-I-L, has anti-myeloma properties with Velcade in preclinical studies. And even if a person isn't clinically depressed, would it be worth looking into? And so she revealed the lead, which is that drug is an antidepressant, and like so many drugs, Velcade is a very sensitive drug, and it seems to react well with a number of different drugs and compounds, and it also has problems with some. For example, you might have heard of green tea isn't a good idea the day before, maybe the day after that you're getting your Velcade. I guess I'm just getting an echo. But I think, yeah, that's a good idea. It reminds me of Bioxin, which is an antibiotic, that is often combined with some myeloma combinations that seems to help. So down the line, I wouldn't be surprised if that's a possibility. Let's see, what do we got? Elena, is a watchful waiting approach still standard protocol for smoldering myeloma or myeloma with no CRAB symptoms? CRAB is an acronym for, don't ask me what it's an acronym for four basic ways that a physician would identify active myeloma. If there are no CRAB symptoms, but you've got a severely compromised immune system, what should I do? And again, referring back to the working group, the IMF working group feels that watchful waiting is still the recommended approach. There are a number of clinical studies right now looking at trying to hit smoldering myeloma before it becomes active. I know smoldering myeloma patients tend to have compromised immune systems. That seems to be the first real symptom that comes along, but they don't have bone involvement. They don't have kidney involvement. So you just got to wait, which, trust me, even though some of our drugs, some of the chemotherapy we take is tolerable, I'd rather wait and watch and enjoy some time drug-free. But that's easy to say now that we're experienced. I think, you know, when you're first diagnosed, you want to attack this baby. You want to get on it. It's just counterintuitive to say you're going to watch and wait. But until they come out with proof that hitting it sooner is going to help, you know, somebody live longer, I suppose that's what I would do, even though it's not very sexy. Cindy, David writes, when thalidomide, Revlimid, oh my God, another one. Oh, Pomalyst is what he meant. Thalidomide, Revlimid, and Pomalyst. Pomalyst is the trade name for the new drug pomalidomide, which is the next generation Revlimid. Let's see. When they don't work and Velcade no longer works, what are the options? Cindy, you took a tough one. You sure you signed up for this one?
Well, yeah, I did, because the first thing, I think you shouldn't give up hope, you know, because just because some drugs aren't working doesn't mean others won't. There are just countless combinations of therapies that can be tried. Once again, I guess being the myeloma teacher, I like giving people resources they could use. And the IMF website, which is www.myeloma.org, has a page that's entitled The Myeloma Matrix. And on this page that's called The Myeloma Matrix, there's a listing of all the myeloma drugs that have been approved for use in myeloma. And there's also, on that same matrix, a list of all the drugs that are currently in different phases of clinical trials. It's amazing how many drugs are on that list. I mean, some I've never even heard of. And I think what struck me was when I did attend ASH this year, I was fortunate enough to hear Dr. Orlowski speak. And Dr. Orlowski is a myeloma specialist from MD Anderson. And what he said is, that we shouldn't necessarily forget about those older myeloma drugs, the ones that were used before the new era of novel agents. And he said that they're still effective in many populations. And he also said that sometimes maybe we could use one of those older myeloma drugs and combine it maybe with one of our newer drugs. So tweaking protocols can help. And the other thing is clinical trials. They're a source of many new promising drugs, and a good way to find a clinical trial for you is the IMS hotline. We'll have somebody that would sit down and talk to you about clinical trials. And the MMRF, which is the Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation, they have something that's called the Patient Navigator, and you can sign up for the Patient Navigator, and someone will help you navigate your way through different trials that may be available for you. There's new classes of drugs coming out, like the monoclonal antibodies are being explored. I also suggest that if you live in an area where there are myeloma specialists available, see them. See what kind of research they're doing in their clinics. And some specialists even offer phone consultations. So even though if those drugs that I forget the questioner's name asked aren't working, there's so many other choices to try to explore. You just need to work with your doctor and probably seek the help of a specialist and talk to one of the counselors at the IMF or the MMRF. There's a lot to do.
Thanks. And let's not forget that our sponsor, CureTalk Trilex, is actually, that's what their company does. And I have a widget on my blog, and you can go in and type in your zip code, and they'll show you, or by state, and they'll show you what clinical trials might be available in your area.
That's great. Yeah.
So I just had to give them a plug. Thanks for sponsoring tonight, guys. Priya, thank you.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure. Bye.
All right. Alan writes. Okay, I just did Alan's. Right? No, David. Okay, I'm confused. Hi, at the moment I'm taking, it's because of the thalamid right up front. Thalamid and receiving Velcade and Cytoxan by IV. My results have been very good so far after just 1 month. Well, that's good news. Have other patients had the same results using this combination? Thank you for this forum. And my answer is yes. That would be not a bad place to start. And if it's working, that's great. Cytoxan is a nice little kicker that can really, really help some of the main drugs work. And the nice thing I like about this is if you, Alan, if you don't develop a lot of peripheral neuropathy, which thalidomide is notorious for, the nice thing about this is then if that works, then Revlimid should work. And so you saved another bullet. I'm actually a gun control guy myself, but I like to use the analogy of saving your bullets for when you need them. So that's another bullet in the chamber you've got. You haven't used Revlimid, you've used thalidomide first, so I think that's a good thing. Okay, next, what are the advantages and disadvantages to a second stem cell transplant? That one's not quite as quick, but the rule of thumb seems to be that if your first transplant lasted 3 years, that your second one would last a year and a half. Now, it's just a rule of thumb. So that means, for example, my transplant didn't work so well, so to just do another one, unless you change something, what do they say the definition of insanity is? Doing the same thing and expecting a different result. But if you had a good result from the first one, you should expect a good result from the second one. It just might not last as long. How's that? Let's see. Cindy, you're up next. Does regular blood work accurately show remission, or are there other means for tracking it?
Okay, I think that's a twofold question there. Regular blood work is an effective way for most patients to show your remission, but not for all patients. I mean, doctors can track your M-spike using the S-PEP or the UPEP test, some other blood tests that they could use on a regular blood basis is the quantitative immunoglobulins, which will tell you how much IgG or IgA or IgM protein you have. There's the serum free light chains assay that also helps, and your CBCs and comp panels will help. And sometimes there might be some other tests depending on how your myeloma presents. If you're presenting with a lot of kidney issues, you might need some kidney testing done, and your vitamin D levels might be tested. But now there's also the small group of patients who cannot track their myeloma using their blood or a 24-hour urine sample. This group is known as non-secretors, and if you happen to be in that group of non-secretors, then you would have to have your myeloma tracked by having some more frequent bone marrow biopsies or maybe some PET scans or CT scans, especially if you're experiencing some of those myeloma-related crab symptoms, crab being if your calcium levels are being elevated, if you're showing some renal impairment, if you're getting more anemia, or if there's more bone involvement. So depending on whether you're a secretor or a non-secretor, there's different ways of tracking your myeloma. The best thing is to ask your doctor, what's he doing to track your myeloma? And then ask him why he's choosing that method to track your myeloma. I mean, the purpose of this teleconference or call is tonight is to empower yourself to learn to be your own advocate. And to do that is you really need to develop a team with your doctors where you feel comfortable asking questions and getting answers. And if you don't understand the answers that your doctor is giving you, ask them again or ask them to explain it in a different way. And finally, if you're still not too sure, you can call the IMS hotline and talk to one of the trained specialists. And they could also send you some brochures that will explain to you the types of tests that are used to track myeloma.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Really helpful. All right, our next question is from someone in Great Britain, in the UK. My husband is in the hospital in the UK undergoing a stem cell transplant. I'm concerned that he will not be offered maintenance therapy following his aggressive treatment, merely follow-up and further chemotherapy when he comes out of remission. What are your views of this strategy? And my understanding, now we're getting far afield, but I actually have quite a few readers from the UK, and they share... and so I follow some international news, and my understanding is that in Great Britain, honestly, it's probably a cost thing. Maintenance therapy after a stem cell transplant is not standard procedure. They might be doing it some as time goes on, but right now it's not. And I have real mixed views about. Using maintenance therapy. I think if you can reach CR in a transplant, if I could have done that here a few years back, I would not have gone on maintenance. But most specialists recommend maintenance, either Revlimid and dexamethasone, dropping the dex after maybe 6 months or a year and staying on Revlimid, or the same with Velcade and dex. The data really supports PFS, it's called, progression-free survival. It almost doubles the time for the myeloma to come back if you use maintenance, but the overall survival is not as impressive, maybe a few months. So we're still sort of waiting to see. That's a lot of poison to take for 4 or 5 years and find out later it didn't make a difference, I guess. So the good news for her is that it sounds like the choice for her husband might be made, and they get to watch and wait, and when the myeloma comes back, the good news is when the myeloma comes back, it hasn't been exposed to these drugs post-transplant, and they could very well be more sensitive than they were going in, and they should work. And so you can see how in the end you might end up in the exact same place. It takes the myeloma farther, longer to get there if you use maintenance, but then your myeloma is used to that Velcade or Revlimid, and if you don't do it and you do watchful waiting, like our friend with smoldering myeloma, then it's likely to come back sooner, but it hasn't been exposed to the Velcade or Revlimid post-transplant. It works right away, and so it's very possible you end up in the exact same place. Cindy, Connie asks, what annual tests are most effective to track multiple myeloma?
This question is a little bit like the last question. First of all, I think the frequency of your testing is going to depend on the characteristics of your disease and probably the stage of your disease. For example, if you're in active treatment, you probably will have your blood work done more frequently than someone who may not be actively in treatment. I have my labs done every about 6 weeks, and some of the tests that I have to track my myeloma would be the serum free light and the SPEP and the UPEP and the quantitative serum. And the one thing that I make sure that I do is I keep track of my labs. I use the Myeloma Manager, The Myeloma Manager is a free program that you can download from the IMF website, and you can put your lab values into it. So this way you could check your labs to see if there's any trends, if your numbers are going up, if they're going down. It's all in one place, and it's a real neat, handy tool to have if you're going to see a specialist to be able to print out this copy that's in a nice little graph form. Other tests that you might consider having are PET CT scans and MRIs, especially if you're experiencing some bone pain, and sometimes bone marrow biopsy might be necessary, especially for the non-secretors. I also make sure I keep copies of all my radiology studies and all my bone marrow biopsies in a binder, and I also ask for having my images from any of the radiology studies I have. I have them kept on a disk, and I just like having all this information so that I know what's going on, and if I do want to get a second opinion, it's very easy for me to bring that information around. Go ahead. I just think it's really important, and to also ask your doctor what tests I should be having, you know, to track my myeloma. Once again, why did you choose these tests? You know, having that communication with your doctor is so important. But educating yourself about what tests that are available is also important.
Sue, did you have something to add?
Not really. No, not on that question. I think Cindy.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I thought I heard you. Thought I heard you get ready to jump in. I think after a while, you know, you hear echoes and.
Yeah.
And we're going to get to Sue again. Sue's still here. We're going to get to her in after just a couple more questions. Pam asked, this is a big question, more information about how nutrition and supplements are having an impact on multiple myeloma. That's a big question. Dr. Dury of the IMF is becoming quite an expert in that. He's taken an interest, which is very rare for a hematologist to even care about nutrition. And so that would be a great place to check. He blogs about nutrition a lot. And that you can, if you go to the IMF site on the far right upper bar there, you can click on blogs and find Dr. Dury's, if he's not blogging about Black Swan, which is a new project that they're excited about, that they're trying to think outside the box and come up with some different ways to attack our cancer. He's blogging about nutrition, and I have a guest columnist on MultipleMyelomaBlog.com. MultipleMyelomaBlog.com. If you add the my in there, you'll go to a really good site a really good site that Millennium has, MyMultipleMyeloma.com, but mine is MultipleMyelomaBlog.com. And Danny Parker is, I call him our lifestyle columnist, because right now he's writing a 7 or 8 part expose about how important exercise is, but for a myeloma patient. But he really focuses on nutrition, talks about different supplements, which ones might be good, which ones not, which foods contain which important compounds. He really does a nice job. So if you go to mine and in the query bar in the upper right-hand side, you just type in Danny Parker. All of his many columns about nutrition will pop up, and I think that's a really good way to get information. And the reason I was thinking MyMultipleMyeloma.com was last night they had a webcast, Exercise and Nutrition. And if you missed it, I'm sure they're going to have a link you can click on and listen to it again. And that's called MyMultipleMyeloma.com. And that's sponsored by Millennium. And the next question, and then we get to hear from Sue again. I'm so excited. We're going to hear from Sue. Kate wrote, any secrets for keeping skin side effects at bay, either from the disease or from the medications, and all I know is I just listened to one of these helpful webcasts, and I can't even recall which specialist, but they were talking about how reducing the dose can really make a difference. Revlimid is a common culprit. Skin rashes causes skin rashes, and normally your body can adjust to that. You cut the dose in half the next cycle. And Dr. Orlowski, that's who was talking about it, an expert from MD Anderson down in Houston. And he was saying that by cutting that dose, that maybe the second and third cycle, that the rashes tend to go away. Cindy was so right. We have got to, and this will be a good lead-in to Sue, we have got to work with our doctors, our nurses, create this team and ask questions and not just let things go. I mean, they always say, how are you doing? Any side effects? What's going on? And then sometimes we're afraid to say something. We know they're busy. We think it's a petty little thing, but we need to let our health team know what's going on so that they can help us. And I think that's really important. So question 14. Pursue. Ed writes, it's a long question. I was just diagnosed with multiple myeloma. I have had some bone loss in my lower spine area, slightly anemic, but no other symptoms at this time. I had my first appointment with a hematologist at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. He is recommending a clinical research study using a combination of lenalidomide, that's Revlimid, bortezomib, which is Velcade, and dexamethasone, a.k.a. Demon Dex, followed by lenalidomide or Revlimid maintenance. One half of the group will receive an autologous stem cell transplant, and one half will not. It's the luck of the draw. I know there are many treatment options out there, and I'm not sure the best way to go about knowing which one's best for me. It seems as though stem cell transplantation is very successful, though not without risks. How can I go about deciding, flip the page, the best course of treatment, and whether it is better to use a standard treatment option or a clinical trial? And all I want to say before I turn it over to Sue is that actually sounds like a trial that makes sense. Either way, the patient wins because medication should be provided at no cost, along with some very stringent follow-up. If you have a preference one way or the other, obviously a clinical trial isn't the way to go. Sue, we've been waiting on pins and needles to hear your voice again.
Well, it almost goes back to that very first question, was about whether it was better to have a transplant or to use one of the new drugs or some of the new drugs. And this sounds like they're doing a clinical trial to try and study, you know, which is the best way to go. But I guess kind of an underlying theme here tonight, and I would echo once again, is it's just so important to have a doctor that you trust. You know, obviously it's not a simple decision to make here, but we just have found, and I have to say we've been through more than one doctor, and there's nothing wrong with getting a second opinion. And if you don't feel comfortable talking to your doctor or asking questions, or if you just don't totally feel like you trust your doctor's opinion, then I think by all means you should seek another opinion. And so I guess my first thing is that you need to have a doctor on your team that you feel you trust. You need to educate yourself. And as Cindy mentioned, I think the IMF hotline is very useful, and the IMF website has some very good educational information. So you need to educate yourself as well. And I really think it's important to have a myeloma specialist on your team before you make a decision like this. Now, I guess the one kind of thing I would warn a little bit is that, you know, when a doctor is involved in doing a clinical trial, they, of course, are trying to get patients into that clinical trial. So I guess you just have to be a little bit watchful of, you know, are they doing this for your own best interest or because they're trying to get patients enrolled? And that's why I guess, a second opinion would be quite important. And it sounds like he says his first appointment was with a hematologist. I would definitely see a myeloma specialist before I would make a decision going, you know, any further than that. And as you mentioned, Pat, it doesn't mean you have to see that myeloma specialist all the time. If that's, you know, if travel is an issue or, you know, for whatever reason, a myeloma specialist can manage your treatment from wherever they're located. You don't have to go there all the time. But before I would make a decision, I think I would make sure that I had a doctor I was totally comfortable with and trusted, and I would make sure I was as educated as could be. And I don't think there's a wrong choice here. I mean, I think they're both have some very good reasons to go either way. I mean, I think we all know there are doctors who especially don't recommend getting a transplant, and there are others who think it's the only way to go. So, you know, there's a division of thought on that, even in, you know, the very well-educated myeloma specialists out there. So, yeah, that I guess is how I would approach it.
And I think that's great advice, and I like the, maybe cynicism is too strong a word, but yes, that physician has a vested interest in filling up that clinical trial. And I think that's a great point. See, we saved the best for last. Oh, wise Sue in Grand Rapids.
I think I might have gotten that from you, actually. Did you have something about that in your book, that the, you know, a doctor who's involved in a clinical study, of course, as you said, they're trying to fill it up. And I read that someplace, and it made sense to me. It's like, don't just jump at the chance, because we found as well that if you see a transplant doctor, it seems like they're chomping at the bit to do a transplant immediately. So you kind of have to consider all that when you're making your decision. They may have, you know, sometimes their interests up at heart too. So you got to consider
and that's
all
a great point, because at least half of the myeloma specialists are transplant docs. So there's a conflict of interest there. It's sort of like going to a surgeon, and most surgeons want to do what? They want to cut.
Exactly.
Most transplants doc want a transplant.
So like you said, you don't want to be cynical, but you have to be realistic too, and kind of take all those things into consideration when you're making your decision.
Yes, and I'm not implying that these doctors are, you know, they have your best interest at heart, and you'd hope that one of these doctors wouldn't push you too hard in one direction or the other, but I guess it's human nature. Priya, we're just about out of time, right?
We have a couple of minutes, and I think I have a question too from one of our listeners. Some person wants to know, how much less effective is Revlimid without taking the Dex along with it?
I know where they're going with that one. Cindy, what do you think?
I didn't understand. Could you repeat the question again?
I was just asking how less effective is, was it Revlimid or Velcade, Priya?
Yeah, Revlimid.
Revlimid
without taking the Dex. Yeah.
I'm not sure. I am not a doctor, so I couldn't even begin to guess how much less effective it would be. I think, you know, that's something you want to talk to your doctor about, and if you're having severe side effects maybe from the steroid, work with your doctor with a plan that maybe you could lower your dose of the steroid and see if the other drug is just as effective, you know. You work with your doctor about tweaking your protocol, but I couldn't tell you whether it's going to be more effective or less effective. That's just beyond my realm.
Good answer, and I'm sorry to just lob that at you out of the blue, but I think that's a great suggestion. I'm assuming, reading between the lines, that this person is concerned, you know, is having side effects from the dexamethasone. I can give you some facts or some statistics, and the statistics, unfortunately, are 30 to 40% more effective. So that's a big deal. The doctors aren't, the specialists aren't quite sure why. You know, dexamethasone alone can help early on, can help knock your myeloma back. So it has some anti-myeloma properties by itself, but for some reason it has a synergistic effect. And for those of you that hope you're getting rid of Dex in the near future, au contraire, Kyprolis, which is the new proteasome inhibitor, similar to Velcade, and Pomalyst, which is an IMID like Revlimid or thalidomide, they all work. If anything, dexamethasone makes a bigger difference with the two new drugs. So I'm sorry, this is something we sort of have to live with, but remember, if you're on maintenance therapy and it's been a year or so and you've got stable disease, ask your doctor if you can either drop the dose on the dex or drop it altogether.
Thank you, Pat. I think I think that was a very wonderful meeting this time. Thank you, Sue and Cindy, for joining us. It was great having you here. We look forward to all of you joining us for the next episode of Cure Panel Talk Show. Please send in your feedback to priya@trialix.com. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you, ladies.
Thank you, Pat.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Sue.
Bye-bye.
Love you guys. Bye-bye.